Welcome to the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
So good morning, everyone. Welcome to BAM PFA, this beautiful theater, to the Bay Area Book Festival. It's a pleasure to be here. I lived in Berkeley up until a few years ago, and PFA didn't look like this, and this festival didn't exist. So it's a pleasure to be back here in this beautiful room. And with this dazzling panel we have here to discuss Cuba with an exclamation point, very important. We were just saying we need the upside down one before the word, but we'll take it as is. My name is Joshua Joey Shapiro. I'm here to moderate this discussion, I suppose. And our panelists, I think, in a lot of ways don't need much introduction. They're easy to look up. We have Accio Bejas, Christina Garcia, and Rachel Kushner. And I think one way to sort of frame what we might talk about here today is that Cuba is a place that in many ways is sort of defined by its animus with the United States, certainly over the last several decades. It's a place that's defined in certain ways by the place it holds in the world's imagination. But it's also a place that people seem drawn to write about through the lens of policy or through the lens of politics. And it's often sort of overdetermined by politics, I think, in terms of how we engage with it, at least in this country. And so I think it's a particular pleasure to be here with three writers who, over the past couple decades, have really written some of the novels, I think, that really matter, the works of fiction that allow us to access history, memory, policy, conflict, but through the lens of individual lives and through the lens of fiction. And so it's a real pleasure to be here with these three writers to be able to talk about some of those things. We'll talk, I suppose, for an hour or so, and then we'll do Q&A. And I wanted, let's see, but as a way to enter into this, maybe I'll start with Accio, because you're the one of us who has a book coming out in a few weeks. Accio has a wonderful collection of stories called The Tower of the Antilles, which will be out shortly. Exhibit A. There it is. And it is a wonderful book of stories that... wasn't me. Was that me? Can you still hear me? Oh, that was scary.
Hello? Is this working? Is it? Okay.
Are we good? We're vaguely good?
Yeah, I don't know. I just kind of went near it. I don't think this is working.
Is it working?
All right, good. All right, great.
I should say, too, one just other brief preamble is that if you guys are like me, you get asked a couple of questions all the time about Cuba, these days especially. One is, should I go? And the answer to that is, well, it's a fascinating, fabulous place. Sure, you should go. The second one is, what's going to happen? And no one knows the answer to that question, so I won't ask it, I promise, in a direct way here. But perhaps we'll get at it in oblique ways. But in any case, by way of a sort of question to start us for you, Accio, in this book of stories and in your work in general, you run through a range of settings, of eras, writing about Cuba, certainly about Havana in the 1950s, about that island hundreds of years ago, about a college town in Indiana. But it seems to me that Cuba is always, in a sense, a character in your work. And I wondered if you could just speak to the ways in which you identify as a Cuban writer and if and how that shapes what you do as an artist, as a writer.
Well, the reason why Cuba comes up all the time is because Cuba comes up in my life all the time. No matter how I may go about my life. I mean, I'm pretty white looking. You know, when I was in college in Indiana, I could pretty much fade into the 7-Eleven and not get followed around. But the truth of the matter is that everything is filtered through the fact that I'm Cuban, and it somehow always, comes back. I mean, I'm a Cuban girl, a Cuban writer, a Cuban exile, a Cuban dyke, a Cuban mom. My kid calls me mommy. So it always is at play in some way. It's not, you know, I'm not trying to write about Cuba. I really am. I mean, it's just, that is my subject, you know, because it's such a big part of my life. It seems an inescapable subject to me. You know, when I talk about my family, I'm inevitably talking about Cuba. When I, you know, a good half of my friends are Cuban, you know. So it's a subject that's of constant presence in my life. And so I'm engaging in it even without thinking about it, you know. It's just what we do. You know, it's funny. My aunt was over at the house. My 81-year-old Cuban aunt was over at the house last week. And, you know, my brother, who's completely Mr. Assimilation, said to me, you know, I had made dinner and all this crap. I had made a little lechoncito and black beans and rice and all this. And my brother said to me, you know, you guys are so busy. Why don't you... you know, get on some sort of, you know, food service or something, you know. And I said, lechoncito, black beans and rice. You know, impossible. We just can't seem to get away from who we are as Cubans.
And, you know, similar question for you, Christina. Can you hear? Yeah. Similar question for you. You, of course, have written several books set in different places often. But again, Cuba returns again and again. It's part of who you are. It's part of the writing you do. But I was intrigued to read you say, I think this was years ago after Dreaming in Cuban came out, we said that you hadn't really realized how Cuban you were until you went about writing that novel, or essentially trying to engage these questions of memory, your parents' memory, family's memories, through fiction. And I wonder if you could just talk about why you think that is, or if there's another way to put that is there something particular to Cuba or to being Cuban in terms of how you access memory and write about it?
Ah, okay. Well, I grew up in New York City. My family left Cuba when I was 2.5. So I considered myself, you know what I did to survive both being Cuban and being a New Yorker? I compartmentalized, you know, 'cause I've said this elsewhere, but... when I'd go through the front door, I was back in 1950s Cuba with all of its strange exigencies, you know. And I remember the first time a boy asked me to go to the movies, and my mother thought, well, who can we get to chaperone? I'm like, chaperone? You know, this is the 70s, Mom, you know, that kind of thing. And so I was constantly navigating and negotiating the home life with its expectations, rules, unreasonablenesses. And then I got the front door and I was in, you know, 1960s, 70s New York, where anything was possible. And so I think for me, actually, I gravitated more to the freedom and excesses of, you know, what was outside the home. But when I began to write, I realized just how much I had internalized of that story and kind of living in the wake of my parents' dislocation and, you know, anxiety and Cuba obsession. And, you know, I felt like Fidel sat to dinner with us every night in one way or another. And so all of that filters through my writing, my consciousness, and you know, and infiltrates, you know, life in ways you can't even particularly predict. So, I mean, I have a book coming out that's set in Berlin, but there's Cubans there too. You know, it's like, where are they coming from?
Right. Yeah, I like to think of, there's a quote by a sort of academic Cuban writer, Antonio Benitez Rojo, who speaks about the Caribbean expanding beyond the bounds of its own sea with a vengeance. Yeah. And I like to think that Cuba seems to do that too. It takes up space and goes around the world.
It has always taken a disproportionate share of the world's attention for myriad reasons, you know, geopolitically, just volume, you know, we could all go on about why that happens, but yes.
Could not agree.
I like saying, speaking of taking up space, I'm often struck when I'm in Havana, people who haven't been there, and they visit, and they say, why are those people fighting? And they say, no, they're just talking about what they're going to have for lunch, you know. Which is to say, the ways of communicating, taking up space, being loud, performative culture, all those things, it sort of seems to abide, for sure. But a question for you, Rachel, to bring you into this. The way in, as I understand it, to Cuba for you was in certain ways thinking about, again, family experience, not by dint of birth, but by having had forebears of yours spend time there before the revolution, in Oriente specifically. And that as a kind of angle of entry, as a way to write about, in particular, the history of the revolution and its after effects, was, it seems to me, the way that you got to Cuba. But I wonder if you could speak to the ways, I've heard you talk before about, as you put it, the ways in which a, quote, aesthetic logic can give us a way to think about the sort of heaviness of history or the sort of gaps in history, perhaps in a novel, perhaps in something else. And I think that's something, of course, that you've done in your work. But I wonder if you could just talk about how Cuba, or how the work you've done in Oriente in particular, may have taught you things about the relationship between literature and history, imagination and memory.
Such a slight and insubstantial question you've asked.
It's early, I apologize.
Going back to the beginning of the question. Yeah, I mean, in a certain way, why I'm on this stage, my connection to Cuba is first and foremost that I wrote a novel about Cuba and takes place in Cuba. And it's very much about the years directly preceding the revolution on the far eastern side of the island, in a place that was effectively an American colony, very close to where Fidel and Raul Castro grew up. And Raul's column was in the mountains right above these towns. And as boys, they had been witness to a kind of exclusive dynamic among these Americans, and also the Americans, United Fruit Company. People probably have heard of that. I mean, as a child of the 20th century, the United Fruit Company was a huge, notorious entity, the octopus. And as somebody who had grown up being interested in Latin American affairs, I was on my own very naturally interested in the history of the United Fruit Company and the way they involved themselves in the foreign affairs and politics, and even overthrowing governments in Latin America. And it just so happened that my mother and her sisters, one of whom's here, lived in Cuba as children in this world that was really dominated by United Fruit. It was a town that was built by the American government to house people who were managers of a nickel mine, extraction and processing. And this is Cuba's second most valuable resource besides sugar. And in Oriente Province, United Fruit owned like 90% of the arable land. They'd been there since 1898. I'm sorry, this is a little information-y. And had really set up this world of very oppressive mores for the Cuban people there, and this dynamic of bringing expatriate Americans over. And people came for different reasons. They could have a better life. They could have servants. Maybe they'd failed to make it, or even could not continue living in the United States for various reasons. So there was a kind of sordid element to some of it, but they'd set up a way of living that totally excluded the Cubans from the area, and yet depended upon them as workers. They would hire cane cutters who worked 4 months of the year and then were let go to wander and suffer for the non-cane cutting season, non-cane processing season. And I went there with my mother and two of her sisters just to see the place. Originally, my first time to Cuba was in 1999. And we traveled very far. This is a northeastern side of the island. It's almost 1,000 kilometers from Havana. There's no tourist would go there. There's no place to stay. There's no restaurant for you. We went back to this town, Nicaro, and my mother and her sisters were the first people ever from among the Americans who'd lived there to return to this place. And it has a very American look to it. It was built for Americans, and like they planted oak and elm trees. And, you know, the women would complain bitterly that their roses couldn't be cultivated in the terrible humidity. And they also couldn't buy iceberg lettuce at the United Fruit commissary. And so there, you know, was this bizarre, xenophobic, obsessive dedication to recreating an American town in a Cuban place. And the town was still there in 1999. My grandparents' former house was inhabited by Cuban people who invited us in, were very warm to us. The man who had been my grandfather's assistant in the plant had got the plant up and running after the revolution and had been made into a kind of personaje. And we stayed with him and just talked about the past, talked about Cuba and now. And I saw the aesthetic residue of this earlier time everywhere. And it became very apparent to me that that time was not incidental to the revolution. It played a role. And I met people who had secretly worked to help Raul's column, even while being employed by the Americans. I went to the United Fruit Town, which is next to the nickel mining town, and all of the buildings there had originally been painted this bright mustard yellow, which was United Fruit's trademark paint color that they painted their houses all over the Caribbean and Latin America. It's a kind of way of saying, you know, we own this space. And those structures had not been painted since 1958. And you could see the residue of this paint. And it was kind of a very inviting metaphor for me to try to go back and look at that lost environment and how strongly those residues had persisted and maybe write a novel about it.
You know, what's interesting, too, is that I haven't been to the town you mentioned, but all over Cuba, the past is so much more, you know, evident everywhere, partly because of economic issues, infrastructural problems, or whatever. The past is a living, decaying thing before us. Most of it hasn't been whitewashed, except, you know, little areas that were UNESCO sites. So it's and everyone comments on the cars, all the Chevys and all the cacharros going up and down the malecón. My daughter and I were there a few years ago, and we counted as we were sitting there. She was, 18 and having her first daiquiri, you know, over the malecón. And we were counting probably a good third of the cars operating in Havana are pre-1959 cacharros, wouldn't you say, Achi? Maybe a third? Yeah, that's an astonishing number. I mean, here they're kept in climate-controlled, you know. I mean, there everything is put to use. Nothing goes to waste. And history is everywhere evident. You cannot escape it. And
history is also inside the homes. I mean, you know, my girlfriend's mother had, you know, a washer from 1952. She had, you know, a blender that, you know, had, you know, was from the 40s, for God's sake.
Yes.
You know, the refrigerators in the interior are all pre, you know, 1959, if those refrigerators.
Even like the cleavers my aunt used, you know, to kill this duck. I'm like, where's that from? It felt like she used it to cut sugarcane.
People hold on to all this stuff. It's really important to them to, you know, make it work and keep it going. And even if the insides are no longer the originals, they just keep those appliances and those things going.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the really interesting things to me is always about the revolution, and having, I've been going to Cuba now for 20 years, lived there for a time, is that, you know, we think of revolution, or at least the way it's propagandized there, certainly say, okay, there was this big break and the past is done and now there's this new thing. And of course, what's interesting, though, about revolution is all the ways in which the past persists in these really palpable ways, even in sort of material life, the cars, the appliances, everything like this. But I wanted to say about what Rachel was saying about Oriente and about the scale of Cuba. I think it's something that people who haven't been there, and even I often see this little line in newspapers or something, they'll say, this little island in the Caribbean, you know, it's not a little island. In fact, it's huge. You know, it's 800 miles long. It contains all these distinct regions. The difference between Havana and Oriente, the East, is profound. Oriente being much more related to the Caribbean, to Haiti, to Jamaica. There are all these fascinating sort of differences and complexities. And it's important to say, too, that the Castro family, right, is from Oriente. That Fidel and Raul grew up in rural Oriente. Their father, you know, ran fields, cut cane for United Fruit. And of course, after the revolution, one of their big claims to kind of you know, socialist authenticity was saying, okay, we split up those lands and now the workers are...
They burned that cane, actually.
Right. They burned that cane, exactly.
Actually, right. At 13, Fidel tried to organize his father's workers against his father.
Yes, that's right.
It's actually a kind of a crazy story, but...
Indeed. Around when he wrote the letter to FDR, right, asking for, yes, for $10.
There's a great book, which I'm... Actually, you may remember the name of it, but it's about the Dolores School, and it was about all of these...
The Boys from Dolores.
The Boys from Dolores. Oh,
yeah.
I highly recommend it, and it gives you a real sense of the lives and complexity of, you know, kind of social interaction in those days. I mean, the influence of the church, the different hierarchies. I mean... Fidel and his brother, I think Raul, were the sons of their dad's liaison with the housekeeper, you know, and so there were many reasons why he became who he became, and he was horribly discriminated against in these elite schools that his father sent him to. Anyway, the Boys from Dolores is a really good insight into how they became who they became. I think
absolutely, yeah, no, these rural.
The Boys from, it would be Dolores. It sounds like Dolores. Dolores.
C-O-L-O-R-E-S.
Which is, yeah, it's just the Jesuit school in Santiago where they went with the kids of the Bacardi family, the other elite of that end of the island. But it's important that they were from that end of the island and came to Havana. But I wanted to ask you, Christina, because, of course, your last book, King of Cuba, you, after having... Achi, I think you just said, you know, Fidel was sort of at the table growing up. Right. You said, well, there you go. Christina said it. But what I'm leading up to saying is that Fidel has this kind of presence, right, in one's life if you're growing up in a Cuban household over recent decades. But you, of course, got to a point where you wrote about him as a character in a novel in this sort of fabulously, mordantly funny way, among other things. But I wonder if you could just talk about your journey to actually writing that book and sort of creating El Comandante as character.
Well, thanks. Yeah, this book is King of Cuba. It came out a few years ago, and it features a fictional Fidel Castro as well as one of his many nemesis on the other side of the Straits of Florida, Goyo Herrera. By the way, we've just adapted it into a play. Do you guys know Marga Gomez? She played Fidel in the stage reading. She was hilarious. And we're going to be doing a production of this at Central Works Theater next summer. But, and I chose Marga because of the certain kind of performing of masculinities that happens in the Cuban context, you know, and I think, and Achi was in the play too. She played, she played chorus man number one.
I believe so.
Yeah,
yes.
I think so. Yeah. And had various wonderful roles. And anyway, I'm saying all of this because I think it took me that long to be able to feel like I could get in the bloodstream after decades of, you know, absorption, analysis, watching, listening, and kind of reconceive him and leave all that history in a way on a shelf and just try and imagine the man. Imagine him at 4 years old, seeing his father coming out of the bath for the first time and imagining he wants those cojones. I'm going to be the one with the biggest cojones on the island. You know, like crazy. It's satirical and kind of outlandish. But I also think, I know I'm being rambling a little bit, but I also think imagining him, but also imagining in a way a titanic, in his own mind at least, a titanic enemy in terms of the exile, his exile opposite, octogenarian. And it's something to me in just playing back and forth between these octogenarians, which made me realize or just confirm something that I had long seen, which is that they're necessary to each other, that they're flip sides of each other, and that one cannot exist without the other. And the reason the shouting match has endured these many decades and at the decibel level it has is because they're fighting with themselves. They're the same person. They're the same people. It's flip sides of the same argument, but the vehemence on both sides is equally equally strong. I don't know. Did I answer your question?
Certainly.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
You know, Christina has twice done things that are completely revolutionary in Cuban and Cuban American literature. The first one was, of course, Dreaming in Cuba, in which, you know, for the first time, there was a book that sort of showed both sides of the argument, but without hate. Like, both people had, you know, a legitimate reason for the positions that they had. It was a very, you know, interesting book because it was so conciliatory, and that hadn't happened yet, either in Cuba or in Cuban American literature. And then when King of Cuba came out, I thought to myself, well, goddammit, she did it again. Because one of the interesting things about Fidel Castro is that he's omnipresent. You know, he really is sitting down at the table with you, but he is curiously missing in Cuban and Cuban American arts. He really does not exist in any realistic way. You know, a few painters have tried to paint him and then they get ostracized. You know, in Miami, he is either, you know, he makes small cameos, but he doesn't really go anywhere. So it was really fascinating to me to see this entire book dedicated to this, this, you know, huge, you know, personality and curse and blessing and all these things that we think of him as, and to actually make fun of him. That just, I think he is so terrifying for good and bad reasons that most people just completely stay away from him. And, you know, King of Cuba kind of broke that curse, I think, in some important ways.
Interesting. Oh, thank you. And of course, it's worth mentioning that in Cuba, it's very striking that when you go there, and of course it's known for the billboards, the propaganda billboards extolling socialism and the image of Che is everywhere and all these things. But for years, the government was always careful to say, we don't have a cult of personality here. Fidel's image is not up as much. Of course, it was there a bit. And of course, there was this whole ironic thing when he died that Raul said, you know, gave this big speech and said, so as not to have a cult of personality in Cuba, we're not going to name streets and parks after my brother, you know.
But yet they're very careful about his image. I mean, back in 2001, I published a book called Days of Awe, and the Cuban Ministry of Culture was very interested in publishing the book because the book has a history, the background of the book is the history of Jews in Cuba. And they were really, you know, hot on Jewish tourism. You know, they had all these plans for, I mean, this was before the Hotel Rachel, which is the kosher hotel in Havana and all this stuff. And so they were hot to do this. They were real, and they got Random House to give them the rights. They, you know, the minister wrote this pleading letter. And he had not actually read the book. And I kept saying to him, you know, you might want to read the book. Might just be a good idea to read the book. And, you know, so he had a... Yeah. So he had a little committee read the book, and they determined there was a problem. So this is my favorite part of the story. Abel calls me collect to tell me that there's a problem. And I said, well, you know, can you... Okay, what's the problem? And he said, well, there are two scenes that are really problematic. And one was Fidel, you know, doing whatever, what do you call his name?
Pull-ups.
Pull-ups. And I mentioned that his belly was soft. This is, that you can't do that, you know? And then there's another scene in which a young Fidel happens to see the narrator's father coming out of the river, and he's naked, and you know, he sees that he's circumcised, and you know, never seen something like that. He kind of goes, "What the hell?" And you know, Abel says to me, "You know, Fidel cannot look at another man's penis." And I was like, "I was like, you realize that there's nothing erotic in that scene. That it's just a curiosity. He's like, 12 or 13 in that scene. And that scene is actually based on a little something that happened between Fidel and my dad. But it was, and Abel was like, no, we can't. He cannot look at another man's penis. So we have to excise both of those scenes. And he was like, it won't affect the story. And I'm like, well, that's not going to happen. So they ended up not publishing it. But his letter of apology is also just a fascinating document. I've always kept it because he talks about how I must think they're crazy, but that they have to protect this man who has given so much. So this was the reasoning.
I was going to say, the pinga is serious business in Cuba.
You gotta, yeah. Can
watch out.
Add
yes.
Something? Just because I also have Fidel as a character in my novel, Telex from Cuba, minor character. And there's a scene late in the book in the mountains. And as I said, Fidel and Raul grew up near these Americans, and then Raul's column, the fifth column, was in the Sierra Maestra, right above Nicaragua. So the Americans met Raul. They were kidnapped by him, had a wonderful time. My grandfather was bitterly disappointed that he had left Cuba just before that took place, so he didn't get to get kidnapped because they lay around in hammocks, and the Cubans who did not drink, they were busy trying to stage a revolution, gave the Americans rum and gave them guns to have target practice, and it's very funny. So there's like a lot of interaction between them, and I put them in the book because they're an important part of the story. And there's a scene where Fidel has a slightly, it's not sexual, but a kind of erotic encounter with a character who's come to Cuba and wound up in the mountains training the revolutionaries. He's a kind of like paramilitary personality. And he and Fidel have just an interaction. And when my book came out, my aunt has a good friend who's close to Fidel, had made a documentary about him and was somebody who'd managed all through the years to stay in good graces with the inner circle. And she said, I'm so excited about your book. I'm going to bring a copy to Fidel. And I thought, oh my God, here we go. You know, Fidel's going to read my book. And I forgot all about that, or I just didn't even think that it would bother him. And then I got a phone call. She said, Raquel, what were you thinking? She goes, I am not bringing your book to him. And in fact, everybody in Cuba, they were like, you know, we love your book, but why? Why did you do that? And I thought, why did I do that? And I realized that there were probably, in a way, it was, you know, I grew up in the 1980s in San Francisco and was very aware of Cuba's policies. And the way that Fidel treated gay people. And I think that I was sort of maybe even unconsciously sort of exacting just a little bit of revenge on this like monolithic requirement for machismo, and particularly Fidel's machismo, because Raul was always the one that people said was gay. And I always thought it was almost a kind of racism because he looks more Asian and may have had a different mother, and it's an othering of Raul. So I reversed it and made Raul the super macho one. Anyway.
Well done.
Although it's very curious, you know, the Raul is gay thing is a thing that happens in exile. In Cuba, he's actually perceived as the consummate family
totally.
Man.
Totally. He's the military.
But he's also the consummate family man. He's the guy who keeps track of all of the nephews and nieces, you know, when you know, stray illegitimate children of Fidel need to come back to see relatives, he's the one who greets them at the airport.
Can be gay and do that too.
But in Cuba he doesn't have that. He doesn't have that reputation in Cuba. That's not his rep. His rep is he's the responsible guy. He's the inward looking guy, and it's really interesting because everybody in Cuba has somebody who lives abroad. It's without fail, except Raul Castro. All of his children have remained in Cuba, and all of his children are in positions of responsibility somewhere in government. And you know, they're not like, you know, nominal titles the way a lot of Fidel's kids, for example, have. You know, I mean, one of them is like the in charge of, you know, baseball database or something, and the other one, and there's another one. I'm not kidding. Who is in charge of you know, the performance theses at the Art Institute. I mean, the guy doesn't even have an art background. So it's all these weird things. But, you know, Raul's kids are actually engaged in stuff. They're actually doing stuff. So it's very interesting that he has this rep and that he's, you know, this way. And then in exile, almost to sort of, I think, undermine all that, he, you know, he becomes the faggot, you know, in a very big and direct way. When I was a little kid, there was an exile magazine called Zigzag that came out in Miami, and it actually drew him with a ponytail and a little red barrette in the back, and he always wore heels, you know.
That's so crazy. But, I mean, I know we can keep talking and talking about Fidel, you know, as we all have for our entire lives, but I do think that it's part of, yes, always part of our imaginations, always looming larger, always being distorted and accommodated to different situations. He's kind of just utterly fascinating. And I think also, you know, that charisma and sex appeal he had in the early days, you know, I put this in Dreaming in Cuba, it was based on something my grandmother had. After her husband died, supplanted his picture on the nightstand with Fidel's, and was always sort of whispering sweet nothings to him. When my mother arrived, you know, the crazy exile arrived, she flung that picture into the sea, but the next day it was back. I don't know how. I don't know how that happened, but it did happen. So yeah, so it's just, but we haven't even, look, we're talking about him as if he's still alive. He died, right? But he still is sort of living on, and we're all in this room talking about him obsessively. What more could he want, really?
Well, that of course was the irony of being, I was there at the sort of final send-off in Santiago when Raul gave the speech, and it was, you know, the sort of, we don't want a cult of personality around Fidel, and this guy just like, that, you know, that boat took off a long time ago.
Like 1957.
1957.
Yeah. Right.
That's 60 years ago. Like, the guy is here, right? But it was remarkable that in December when that happened, I remember going down for the end of the sort of funeral march. And you may recall, I mean, there's a lot else going on, and the world kind of paid attention for a couple days, and then, you know, the cameras move on. But in Cuba, of course, the country really came to a standstill for 9 days. There's no drinking allowed. There's no nothing. 9 days, of course, also being the amount of time that in Santeria, it's said that that's how long it takes a soul to leave the body. So it's this very interesting thing, of course, that ran all the way through.
The communist soul takes longer, I heard.
Communist soul may take longer. But they went with the nine. And the procession ends, you know, in the sort of cemetery in Santiago. And then there's this big rock. Have you all seen pictures of the rock where he's buried beneath? Anyway, they just did a big boulder with his name on it. It just says Fidel, right? Right next to Martí, of course, the great national hero of the 19th century. But I want to ask you, actually, because you wrote an op-ed, and then we can move on from Fidel.
So never.
Never. But a final question, Nachi, you wrote an op-ed for the Times when he died. You said you felt, I feel strange, relieved, and a little sad. I'm wondering how you feel now, 6 months later.
Not that much different, really, you know, because here's the thing. I think regardless of the effects that the revolution has had on our different families at different times. You know, he was a very, I think he was a dictator, but I think he was a very different kind of dictator. You know, whatever his ego, you know, was about, there was also a lot of stuff going on with him that was important and interesting. You know, I do think he was very sincere, although not, I do think he was very sincere about his concerns about, you know, racial equality. I do think that had a lot to do with him coming from Oriente. I do think he was very sincere about, you know, healthcare as a universal right. And I think he, you know, really put it on the table for, you know, non-European countries in a way that was never heard of before. I do think he admired the United States greatly, but I do think he resented the United States greatly. And I think that is something that I think a lot of Cubans, maybe most Cubans, feel. You know, there's tremendous love and admiration, but also just get the fuck off my neck, you know? And I think, you know, he articulated things sometimes in ways that were very important. I mean, I do think, you know, all of those things were problematic. You know, the racial campaign was incredibly problematic. The fact that it was handled so badly, is now sort of coming to light, and they're writing about it in Cuba, you know, and Afro-Cubans are actually speaking for themselves instead of the government speaking for Afro-Cubans. And, I think there are issues with the medical system that need to be, contended with and fixed, and a lot of those are economic, but a lot of those are not economic. And Raul is kind of actually, again, he's the inward guy. You know, he's pulling a lot of the foreign missions out, and he's bringing them home. And so, you know, they're doing things that they hadn't done before. I mean, under Fidel, what no one quite grasps about the Cuban health system is it's a preventive system. It doesn't have specialties. You know, it keeps you from getting sick. But if you get really sick, you might be screwed because there might not be anybody who can actually do anything for you. And that's actually on Raul's plate. He's trying to change that, you know. Fidel, I miss him in good and bad ways, you know. I'm sorry he's not around to kick anymore. And it's interesting how my older relatives are all sort of deflated without him. You know, Raul just isn't.
I feel that too. They're all depressed. Yes.
You know, the conversation just is not the same.
No.
You know,
Raul, it's like all the life is drained out of them.
Right.
Yes.
They just have nothing to say, you know. Some even voted against Trump. They just lost their way. They really have.
After all the pot banging, you know, that first couple of nights, and it's like they've exhausted themselves, and now without their arch enemy, you know, what are they going to do? Just go shopping? Yeah, tan perdido. That's it. Yeah.
Just a final quick thing about Fidel, and then I want to say something about another thing that Achi brought up. Well, my family are not Cuban, but they lived in Cuba as children, so that it's a very formative component of their identities. My mother and her sisters and in my family, they are hardcore Fidelistas. And I think it's because of what they saw as children in the living conditions of the people who worked cutting cane and worked for the nickel mines and worked for the American families who lived there. And it's, lifelong kind of political formation for them. So in my family, there's like really not much critique of Fidel would be allowed. And my aunt has an enormous photo of him when you walk in the house. And they're all very somber when he died. Achi said something earlier about Raul's family, unlike either other Castros or Cubans generally, not having relatives abroad. And it reminded me that in what I still call Oriente, which was a huge province that was then subdivided after the revolution, many people are not related to anyone who lives abroad. And this does seem to fall along racial lines. And we know lots of Black Cubans, particularly people who had come from Jamaica, whose grandparents had come to work as cane cutters, and people who'd come from Haiti also to cut cane, who do not have relatives who left Cuba and are not getting remittances. And you can see these differences quite severely on the eastern side of the island. The eastern side of the island is not Havana. Many people are not white. It was historically a Black province. Slaves came from Africa. People came from Haiti to cut cane. People came from Jamaica. And there wasn't a sort of middle class exodus from those areas in, 60, 61, 62, when a lot of people left, and they don't have relatives abroad. And it's just, to me, an important part of the story.
Yeah, I mean, that's true of Black Cubans all over the island. It's not just in Oriente. It's true in Havana. It's true everywhere. That seems to be a truth. And then there are pockets of places where, you know, like in Guantanamo, a lot of Afro-Cubans do have people abroad because of the linkages to the base. Because one of the peculiarities of the base is that after the embargo went into place, the Cuban government allowed the Americans to continue to employ those people who had already been employed in 61. I did a piece for the Chicago Tribune about, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, on like the last seven guys who are like in their 80s, you know, who are still, you know, they still get picked up by a little shuttle and taken to the base to work every day. But at one point, there were thousands and thousands and thousands of these guys who worked in the base. You know, but it's absolutely true that Afro-Cubans across the board are much less likely to have remittances from abroad, even when they have relatives abroad. But they, for the most part, do not. That's true.
You know, just an aside about Guantanamo, I don't know if people know the sort of actual legal fact of that place, right, is that the U.S. signed this 100-year lease in the 30s and now sends apparently a dollar check a year that Fidel forever refused to cash.
Yeah. A bunch of those are up at the Museum of the Revolution.
There they are, yes. You can go see these checks at the Museum of the Revolution, right next to the Hall of Cretans, where you have Reagan and Bush and all the rest. But I was going to say, you know...
Curiously, not much on the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Curiously. I was going to say, though, on this subject of remittances, right, that, of course, one of the things about Cuba now, and when you go there and sort of see how the economy works or doesn't work, right, is that essentially to do well there, to have things that people covet, is about having access to dollars, is about having access to foreign money, which means either having relatives abroad or working in tourism or in a sort of part of the economy where you have contact with foreigners, right? And I'm just curious, that the three of you, have you been spending time there the last couple years, or when was the last time you were in Orlando?
No, I haven't been to Cuba since 2003. But I brought it up because there is a dynamic of class differences in Cuba, despite the socialist structure of the economy, and it plays itself out through race to some degree.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Race and proximity to Havana.
Yes, and again, as you said, access to tourism as well. I haven't been to Cuba in a few years either, but I went a lot in the 90s during the so-called Periodo Especial, special period. And so you really could see there just the growing socioeconomic disparities, all hinging on access to foreign currency, dollars, etc. And I was staying with my uncle in Havana, and his family in Havana, and his neighbor, who was a neurosurgeon, was... baking these wonderful meringue cakes for birthday parties, quinceañeras, other things, and that's how he was kind of making ends meet. People were, you know, having two or three jobs. It was, on average, I think it was, they keep statistics on this thing, I think on average, the average citizen of Havana lost 30 pounds in a year. Everyone was like, what? You know, because there was no gas, they were riding these pigeon bicycles from China.
They weigh like 10 pounds. You know,
yeah,
heaviest
things, are all kinds of accidents too. People died on these things, but whatever. But I'm just saying is that people, and we've joked about this before, Archie, but you know, the national verb of Cuba is resolver, to resolve, and one way or another, whether it's cannibalizing, you know, a carburetor from a Russian Lada to put in an old Chevy or whatever, people somehow, I mean, not that it isn't desperate at times, but people survive. People make it work.
The economy also has like strata that are hard to explain in sort of the kinds of economic terms that we think about. For example, there's what I call the class that has access to what? Not necessarily access to dollars vis-a-vis tourism or remittances, but access to particular privileges that allow them to
travel
and make money. Once upon a time, if you had an opportunity to leave Cuba, you left. Now, a lot of people do not leave. What they do is they parlay their intellectual expertise or their artistic expertise abroad, make dollars, and come back. Because, A, they don't have to you know, they don't have to report those dollars, and they very rarely do, and they live very well on those dollars in Havana, much better, not just that they would here or anywhere else, but much better than not just the average Cuban, but even the above average Cuban, you know. And I'm not talking just about artists who, of course, make gaboodles of money, or writers, but also scientists.
Engineers. My uncle works in Venezuela for part of the year, makes a ton of money, and comes back to Cuba. Yeah.
And so, you know, it's about being able to get to what, you know, it's about being able to do two things. You know, one, connect internationally so that you can get invited out, and two, then have a smooth way to get the permit to get out, which is not always as obvious as one might think. Sometimes it can be a very complicated experience.
Yeah, and it's a fascinating thing that a lot of people talk about this in Havana, that in a lot of ways, the new social elites, right, are not people who we think of as elite here, lawyers or political people or doctors. You know, it's often artists or people who have access to travel, access to outside funds, right? It's an interesting dynamic. And Havana, to go there now, it's extraordinary because in a lot of ways, you know, it looks the same. You'll be in a block and say, okay, this is what it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. But then every other block, you sort of turn a corner and someone has turned, you know, this beautiful old house in Vedado into a, you know, shishi tapas bar where if you have money, you know, there's places to spend money. And so there's a strange sort of overlay of this capitalist consumerist economy on top of what has been there. And it's a very eerie thing to sort of go and experience. But at the same time, you turn a corner and people are, you know, living
the
on
thing.
Their...
People...
Yeah, they're
the,
Cuba's
poor.
That's it. Yeah.
And Cuban people make very little money as a whole, as a general sense. But Cuba's expensive.
Yeah.
Cuba's actually really expensive. You know, you can easily... you know, drop $90 for a meal for two without anything too fancy, you know, in Havana. That's less true in the interior, but it's not untrue in the interior. One of the things that's happening that Raul is doing very quietly is that he's creating tourist centers in the interior. You know, the islands off... what used to be Las Villas and is now Santa Clara.
Cayo Coco.
Yeah, Cayo Coco have been, you know, turned into these phenomenal tourist places that Cubans are not allowed in.
There's not that much trickle down either to the average Cuban all this tourism.
Theoretically, Cubans are allowed, but in fact, it's impossible because it's $165 a day at the cheapest one, you know. They're, the only Cubans you see are Cubans serving Americans and Germans and whatever, you know. And he's also, you know, and he, you know, Raul has also developed this tourism idea of targeting certain places for certain nationalities, like for whatever reason, Bay of Pigs is all about Germans, you know. I really
Germans
don't know
love
why,
the Bay of Pigs. It's...
But that's who's going there,
true.
You know.
Canadians, Veradero. Yeah, go ahead.
Because you'd asked originally, had any of us been to Cuba recently? I have not been, but I stay in touch with people there through my mother and her sisters and people that we talked to who they knew as kids. And I asked a while back, this is right before Fidel died, what was going on there in Nicaro, the town where much of my novel takes place, what's happening with the nickel mine. And they said, well, the mine was closed and the processing plant was closed. And then our friend Elena Delgado said enthusiastically, but Raquel, people are working to dismantle the plant. So we have jobs right now with that, with the dismantling of this plant. So the tourism has not at all helped people's lives there or the economy in that part of Cuba. And they had two really devastating hurricanes over the last 15 years, like incredibly devastating. And this is also an area where a lot of people don't have remittances. And it's hard to get food there, oddly, even though it's rural Cuba. You go to Havana and you have money, you can go to a restaurant and eat. There's oftentimes no food even to buy around Nipe Bay because they you know, never really transitioned from their monocrop economy of growing sugarcane, and they've tried to do cooperative farming. It hasn't always worked for whatever reason. There's disorganization and distribution issues, and they don't really have good infrastructure there. There aren't roads. Also, people don't own cars there. We showed up there several times in a rental car, and it immediately alerted the CDR. Like, there's a car in this town. Who owns that car? We had to go down to Mayeri, fill out all these forms, talk to officials, because there were phone calls. There's a car in town. You know, it was, of course, just a crappy Lada. Like, you know, not a cool 50s car. But so there are parts of the island that seem to me to continue to suffer. And just one last thing about that. When after Fidel died, there was this pledge. Did you guys read the pledge? That there was a pledge that had been prepared before his death by him and the kind of top, whatever they are, the Politburo committee. And
about posthumous life and the commitment to the revolution.
Yeah, and people were waiting in long, long lines to sign this pledge. And if you're kind of, you know, a cynical outsider, you would think, like, are people pressured to sign this pledge? And why are they signing this pledge? And in a certain way, I think it's impossible to know what that's like unless you are a Cuban who lives in Cuba. But from our Cuban friends who I spoke to about signing the pledge, I can't assume that they can be completely candid and honest with me on the phone or even with themselves. But I came to a conclusion about the pledge for myself that I think is something that's true. And I'll just share it quickly. It's that people have suffered a lot, and especially in the special period, which Christina brought up. And like the people in the East, I know people who are poisoned from having made their own soap and having mishandled the lye when they were making soap. And there's been so much suffering over so many years that the idea of just letting in this huge infusion of American cash and losing control of any kind of Cuban participation in what the destiny of that country is going to be is unpalatable to people. And I think that when you have suffered, you want to have suffered for something and not for nothing. And that was my sort of analysis of why people were so adamant about waiting to sign the pledge is, you know, for the whole thing to have been progressing in a direction and also to be participants in the future of that direction.
Yeah. And it's a very interesting thing, of course, just in the last few months that, of course, there was this historic opening, this historic rapprochement that Obama was able to sort of initiate. Now, of course, there's chatter about pulling that back. We almost got through this panel without really mentioning the guy in the White House. But I was going to say, it's interesting, when he was elected in Cuba, it was funny to talk to people there because people, there was a familiarity. It's like, oh, he's one of those like crooked hotel guys. Like, yeah, we know that
guy. We know about them.
He ran this place in the 50s, you know. And so it's a funny kind of, you know, people were kind of humorous about it. But it was also an interesting thing, to the extent that I have conversations when I'm there with anyone in the kind of realm of officialdom and security people. When he came in, there was also, I could tell there was a real kind of, they were like, oh, we're back on footing that's comfortable. That guy doesn't like us. We're back to being adversarial. You know, the Obama thing of like, oh, we're going to flood you with money and people and change stuff. That was unsettling in a lot of ways to people who whose job it is to sort of uphold the state and the military and so on there, which speaks to the effectiveness of the policy in all kinds of ways. But it was very interesting.
Obama was unsettling not just because of that message. He was unsettling because he was black.
Well, indeed.
And so the message was completely complicated for Cubans who were used to white Americans looking down at them. And suddenly this very attractive black guy, who, by the way, in Cuba is rumored to be half Cuban. I'm not making that up.
See, they claim that in Jamaica and Trinidad, too.
I'm not making that up. At some point, his mother did a solidarity trip to Cuba and apparently got friendly with some guy in Sagua La Grande. And the rumor is that she came back pregnant and that, you know, the African dude just stepped in to save the Cuban dude's sort of dignity, I guess. But that is... that.
You know? I will say that when he came to Havana, I heard so much more chatter about the car, about the
Bestia. The black car, yeah, the beast.
The limo.
Yeah.
The mania for cars in that time.
I mean, I think the Obama message was complicated because so much of what Cubans have heard historically is the United States is this incredibly racist place. It's this incredibly, oppressive place. And here comes this black guy who, you know, first of all, is black. Secondly, is kind of cool. And, you know, moves in
Maybe
a cool way.
He has a little rhythm. Yeah.
You know, he has a little, tumbao. You know, and so
like a Cuban swagger.
Yeah.
Translation.
And he's talking about things that young people actually do want, which is, you know, access to the internet, ability to travel, you know, to sort of lead their own lives, to pick their own majors when they go to college, which isn't has not been happening for the past 10 years.
As I'm about to weigh in, you say what I'm about to say.
Yeah,
so this is where like completely telling
that. You know, so I think that was one of the great complications. I mean, that they were trying to figure out how to contend with this guy. One of the most interesting things that happened after the Obama visit was that the entire Cuban government started to organize to, you know, answer and push back on everything that Obama said. It was fascinating. Every day they had a new guy out there talking, and they were all like under 50. It was a really deliberate move. It was also really interesting that once Obama got elected to the United States, Raul elevated a bunch of Afro-Cubans. And one of the most notorious things about the Cuban government is that prior to Raul, there were very, very few Afro-Cubans in power. Very few, and very few women, and very few people under 50. You know, Abel Prieto, our buddy at the Ministry of Culture, was the youngest minister when Fidel named him, and he was already 59. And when Raul came in, then Obama, he made these gigantic changes to suddenly change the Politburo, the Central Committee, so that it would look more like Cuba. It was the first time since 1959. You know, the president of the National Assembly is black now. That's the first time since 1959 in a country that's majority of color. That's not...
Yeah, it's a classic pyramid there in terms of socioeconomics and whatever.
So I'm getting sick. Should we take a question or two before we before we wrap? Yeah. There's a mic going around.
There's supposed to be one of our mics.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, all right. I think they're coming for mics. Yeah.
Take it away. I think you turned it off.
There we go. Thank you. So I've actually written a novel about my partner, who was a Marielito, queer Marielito, who came over. And my aunt and was working in the university in Havana. And she said, oh, let me get you to someone who can translate your novel. And I was shocked that the translator said, oh, yeah, this could be printed now in Cuba. I'm curious about your books, whether they're available in Cuba itself, and whether you hear of any changes that they could be, given some of the stuff that you've talked about already.
Not yet, really. Although I'm always struck when I go to Cuba how knowledgeable they are about what's being published in the U.S. Not just among Cuban American writers, but you know they have a pretty good idea of what's happening, and yet we are in a black hole in terms of. Generally, population-wise, about what's happening there. So, no, officially, there is no, Achi being the exception, you know, there's sort of individual negotiations and things that happen, but there is officially no way to get an American book published in Cuba. That doesn't exist. However, there's this wonderful... a small publishing house in Matanzas that does these handmade books, all from recycled materials. And I've had a couple of those small books published, mostly just short stories and things. And they're illustrated, and the women sit around a big table and glue and paste and staple. I mean, it's extraordinary. The name of the publishing house is... it's a great... Vihia, yeah. And if you go to book festivals abroad at all, in Mexico or otherwise, they always have a booth, and they're exquisite books. But other than that, no. It just doesn't exist.
a couple years ago, an editor named Daniel Santos at Editorial Letras Cubana, which is the big sort of prestige imprint, government imprint, did make a big effort to publish Cuban Americans and actually sought out Cuban Americans. And they published a wonderful collection of stories by Roberto G. Fernandez. In an attempt to, you know, assuage me, I was not heartbroken that Days of Awe wasn't published, but they published a collection of short stories of mine. It's not a translation of anything that has been published in the United States. It's an original collection. And I think they published one other Cuban-American, and then Daniel went to the Dominican Republic, and that was the end of that. You know, this is the thing about Cuba. So much of it has to do with individual effort and who's where at any given time and who knows who at any given time. I mean, it is as much socialismo as socialismo.
And it's worth saying, just a quick interjection about the sort of cultural economy in Cuba and how magazines and other things get around now. There's this thing called El Paquete, which essentially is it's distributed. It's a digital dump of stuff, a terabyte a week of films, TV shows, magazines, The New Yorker, National Geographic, all this stuff. And it's allegedly, and I believe it, you know, the biggest employer in Cuba right now, just distributing this thing. Because there's a network, a private network of people who, you know, it's flash drives, it's guys on bikes who, you know, you give them your hard drive and say, I want, you know, all the new Breaking Bad and The New Yorker, and they'll get it for you. You know, and so there's this fascinating way in which that economy exists as well. It's not the state. You know, it's private, and it's vast, and that's the last 5 years or so. Anyway, we should take...
Yeah, technology is really beginning to take a foothold in Cuba. And in fact, there were a bunch of maybe half a dozen young Cuban technology... They all happened to be men, but they were doing a residency at Stanford for a few weeks. Do you know about this?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a big push on that now, but it's still in it's still pretty nascent. Mari, I feel like you should talk. Can we let this woman talk? Oh, sorry, then we'll go back to you.
Gracias. Hola. Cristina, particularly for you and kind of building on some of the things that we've talked about. I read King of Cuba before, so I could have read it before your stage reading, which was wonderful. And I was really moved by the courage it took to write that. Knowing what I know about your commitment to travel to Cuba, to maintain connection to Cuba, because you put a lot on the line. It was risky. I mean, beyond whether or not your book can get published in Cuba, it's like, what are the consequences of writing something like that? We talked about, like, you can't even mention this short, you know, this little scene where Fidel is noticing someone else's penis. You've got a whole book that, you know, really looks at Fidel's private life, which is never talked about, and satirizes him. So to me, you know, there are a lot of consequences to that. You put a lot on the line as an artist, and props to you. I wonder kind of your process of kind of making a decision, considering that, you know, because we're always juggling, you know, our need for connection.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, yeah.
And the truth to who you are as an artist, et cetera.
No, thanks for that question. I did get this sort of icy vein syndrome occasionally, you know, when I was writing it. But ultimately, I think if you're going to write novels or, you know, tackle these subjects, you have to kind of go with the take no prisoners attitude. I mean, I guess the only thing I could say that I felt it was like an equal opportunity skewering too. You know, I also took on the Miami exile community in the form of this octogenarian nemesis as well. But also to balance it out, there's about 35, 40 other voices, you know, kind of average Cuban voice. I don't know how average they are, but, you know, an array of voices that are contesting, undermining, arguing with these so-called official histories, you know, the Fidel version, the, you know, the official revolution version, and then the official exile version of things as well, both of which have huge swaths of reality denial. So I feel like, Achi was very kind to say that about dreaming in Cuban too. I think I try and just give the various points of view. I don't believe that there is a monolithic way to approach Cuba or to approach Fidel or the exile or anything. I think we need multitudinous voices and many points of view to sort of tackle its complexities. It's not as black and white or as binary as they would have you believe, you know, these the ones who get all the airplay.
Sure, but then they're the ones making decisions about whether you get a visa or a passport to go in.
You know, I haven't tried to go back to Cuba. I guess I'll let you know what happens, you know.
I'll let you in. I think that's a
follow-up on the question. Is it hard to get back in once you've written
a book? Is it hard to go back and forth and get a visa?
I haven't found that yet. But as one of my friends joked not too long ago, if you want to hide secrets and scurrilous material, there's no better place than between the covers of a book. Okay, there's so much competition for our attention these days. So. I don't know. I'm suspecting I'll be fine going back to Cuba.
Maybe I just add that I don't know what kind of visa you travel under, but you don't actually have to get a specific visa to go if you travel as a professional researcher, they call it. You travel under a U.S. General Treasury license. And so you kind of visa yourself and you bring all your documentation and book a flight. And then if they ask how you're legally traveling, you say, oh, I'm going under U.S. General Treasury license as a researcher. So,
but as Cubans, we do need visas, actually.
Yeah. Oh, you do need visas?
If you were born there, yeah, it's different.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but different people have different things. Like, I have a little thing on my Cuban passport, which I'm always really amused by. It's a little stamp that allows me to live abroad. Yeah.
And there's interesting, just anecdotally.
And you know, it's interesting, and it's different for Cuban Americans because Cuban Americans are treated differently going in. You know, for years when I traveled to Cuba, because I traveled to Cuba a lot, because I stayed in Cuba for very long periods of time, because you know they perceived me as I think an interesting character, not just because I was writing books, but because of my journalism background. You know, I was treated like a queen, and I would arrive at Jose Martí Airport, and literally there would be a car from the Ministry of Culture to pick me up, and I would bypass all of the crap that everybody else bypassed, you know, that everybody else had to go through. And then I had a very interesting experience in 2009 when I went with my wife, and, you know, I had sort of coached her on, you know, what to do. But for the first time ever, when I traveled to Cuba, something bizarre happened. We took off from Jamaica, and you know, I remember even saying to Megan, well, this is it, the point of no return, which you knew something then had to happen, right? Because we got to Cuban airspace, and they turned us around. And we ended up spending the night in Jamaica. We were told that there was some sort of problem, that the runway had melted or something. I'm not kidding. That was the actual explanation.
Does, yeah.
When we got to Havana, Abel Prieto later told us, no, that Chavez was visiting, and that was the real problem. But the interesting thing was that when we were in Jamaica, we had to obviously unpack and stuff, and so our luggages got a little bit confused, and somehow or another, the many, 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 many copies of Ruins, my novel that was most recent then, that I was bringing to everybody in Cuba, ended up being under Megan's name, in her bag. And when we get to the airport, I mean, because we were a day late, the Ministry of Culture, blew it, of course, and they weren't there. And I still did my Cuban-American thing, and I had to, I had to pay tons of money for stuff that Megan was not paying. Like my luggage was weighed, and then I was taxed on weight. Megan, on the other hand, wasn't taxed, but every single thing in her bag was taken out. The pens were uncapped. You know, Megan speaks perfect Spanish, but I told her, you don't speak a word of Spanish, right? You need a translator. So that I could hang out and sort of deal with her. And when they opened the bag of books, they took out the books, and the guy says, tell me about this book. And so I tell him a little bit about the book, and he says, well, how do I know this is not a conflict, libro conflictivo, you know? And I said, well, look at the acknowledgments. The acknowledgments, I thank the Ministry of Culture, the current minister, like 29 other Cuban writers. I mean, obviously, friend here, you know? And the dude says, well, hold on. And he flips the book open and he says, just read that page to me. And I said, but you don't speak English. He says, translate it. So I was in the airport performing Ruins for almost 3 hours. It was unbelievable. It was like nothing I'd ever experienced before in my life. And it gave me a real...
You were hooked on that.
I'm like, I guess. It was hilarious. I mean, it was unbelievable. And then at some point, this is also a very Cuban moment. At some point, he decides, it's fine. He's tortured us enough. He's going to let us through. But he doesn't actually have the authority to let us through. Some captain named Margarita, who's on the other side of the room torturing somebody else, has the authority to do this. So he literally yells, Margarita! You know, Margarita pays no attention to him because she's busy with her torture session. And then eventually he just goes, ay, Margarita, vaya. And he lets us go. And I told Megan, let's just scram. I mean, and we just bolted out of there. But it was, you know, these are surreal scenes that happen at the airport, you know, all the time. And you never know when these things are gonna happen. You know, or not. You know, I had missed a lot of those by virtue of the privilege I had been getting.
Indeed. Well, I'm getting motion that we have to wrap up.
Oh, sorry.
No, not at all. Great story, indeed. Excellent note to end on. And I wanted also just to end by thanking our three panelists. And for echoing what Christina said, that we need a multitude of voices on Cuba. So thank you for, and it's not black and white. Thank you. Thank you all.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.